COVID hits Mexico's presidential palace again. Quebec turns to taxes to tame the coronavirus. And artists in Ireland get a break, money to help them weather the pandemic.
I think this is a once-in-a-generation policy intervention.
Also today, the volcano on Spain's Canary Islands stopped erupting at Christmas. Thousands of homes and large farms had been destroyed. People there say rebuilding will take a long time and that officials should listen to them for how recovery money gets spent. I'm Marco Werman, and we all lose track of time, but when a soccer referee does it at a major international match, look out.
If that is the end of the match, it's finishing in confusion here.
We'll try to clear that up. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is good to be back with you. As always, a bit of caution, but there might be some good news on the pandemic horizon. Experts say the spike in cases of the Omicron variant of COVID-19 could soon start to go down dramatically here in the U.S. and in many other nations where the disease is spiking. In the meantime, though, and here's the bad news, it's still spreading. And not just here in the U.S. In Mexico, the president there has now tested positive for the second time. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador appeared in a press conference this week with no mask. A reporter on Monday asked the president if he was losing his voice. López Obrador responded that he would get tested later. By Monday evening, the Mexican president confirmed he had COVID. The World's Latin America correspondent, Jorge Valencia, is following the story. I asked him about López Obrador's condition today.
Well, the president appears to be in good condition. He appeared in a recorded video from his office on Tuesday saying that he had no fever, that he had healthy oxygen levels, and here's a little bit of what else he had to say.
Me da gusto poderme comunicar con ustedes. Estoy ronco, afónico.
President's going hoarse there. He said that, and you can hear it in his voice. We know that his wife and his son, who he lives with, had both gone into isolation after he tested positive. We don't know whether everyone that he came into contact with on Monday before being tested had gone into isolation. That includes at least four members of President López Obrador's cabinet.
How is President López Obrador seen by the Mexican public when it comes to how he's handled the pandemic?
Well, he's seen the same way he's seen with basically anything else. He's either loved or he is hated. He continues to be a president who has high popularity ratings, but those who oppose him vigorously. And primarily, they have criticized the fact that he is one of the world leaders who have clearly prioritized softening the potential economic impacts of the pandemic over preventing and softening the health impact that it can have on his population. He's also said and done a lot of things that have contradicted recommendations that his own health officials have made. I spoke with Marco Tapia Maltos. He's a postdoctoral fellow at the National Medical and Nutritional Science Institute in Mexico City.
It sends a double message, which is counterproductive, because on one hand, we have the health authorities saying, if you have symptoms, you don't need to get tested. You just go and isolate. And on the other hand, we'll see the president that says, oh, I have symptoms, I have a hoarse voice, and I don't use a face mask because I don't believe in it. So there are many things that he says and does that are not a good example to the general population.
And Marco, this has been an issue since the very beginning of the pandemic, almost 2 years ago. At some points, it hasn't been clear exactly what the country is doing in terms of testing, exactly how the vaccine rollout is working. And the president often does not help people gain clarity.
Yeah, mixed messages there for sure. Overall, Jorge, how is Mexico faring with the arrival of Omicron?
Well, Mexico is entering its fourth wave in the pandemic, and it is difficult to put figures to how the country is doing. And that is largely because Mexico is doing relatively very little testing. And even private labs in Mexico City in recent days have said that they are running out of rapid test kits. But the country continues to be open for business. There have been no official mandates for masking. Mexico has been one of the few countries that has not at any point put in testing requirements to enter the country. And the official figure as of last week is that about 300,000 people had died from the coronavirus. But another estimate puts that at something closer to 460,000 coronavirus deaths in Mexico so far. And Marco, the fact that President López Obrador has now tested positive for the second time shows us that in the same way that Omicron has swept through the United States, it is also sweeping through Mexico and throughout the region.
The World's Latin America correspondent, Jorge Valencia, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
And Omicron is still sweeping across the globe, and many governments are fed up. A growing number of countries are imposing vaccine mandates in some shape or form. Those have been very controversial, but Quebec is taking its pandemic response even further. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Quebec's new policy can be summed up as get vaccinated or pay up. Quebec's premier, François Legault, announced the plan yesterday.
The vaccine is the key to fight the virus. This is why those who refuse to receive their first dose in the coming weeks will have to pay a new health contribution.
Health contribution is a nice way of saying tax. Legault didn't say how much the tax would be, only that it would be significant, probably more than $100 Canadian, and it wouldn't apply to people who can't get vaccinated for medical reasons. Other details, like when would this go into effect, or how would the government even find unvaccinated people, none of that is worked out yet. What Legault did say was that this new tax is a matter of fairness.
These people put a very important burden on our healthcare network.
About 10% of eligible Quebecers are unvaccinated, but they take up about 50% of COVID-19 beds in hospitals, according to health officials. Quebec has some of the highest COVID case counts in Canada. The province has tried all sorts of things to slow down hospitalizations. There's a curfew, schools are closed, private gatherings are banned, and last week the government announced it would require proof of vaccination to enter weed and liquor shops. Incidentally, the number of people who booked their first vaccine appointment skyrocketed, again, according to health officials. But this, a sweeping tax on unvaccinated adults, is a controversial move. Quebecers weighed in on CTV News.
Maybe there's a better way to do it, but, you know, I think we're desperate for some kind of solution.
I think people have to find their own way. If they don't want, it's not to me to convince them.
I don't know. Is it legal?
Is it legal? Good question. Reporters asked Prime Minister Justin Trudeau the same thing this afternoon. He said it's too early for him to weigh in, but he added,
different jurisdictions are making different decisions about how to encourage people to get vaccinated. And as a federal government, we will be continuing to be there to support them in those decisions and to make sure that everyone gets vaccinated.
As Omicron rips across the world, more and more nations are getting desperate. Germany and Austria will require vaccines for everyone starting in February. People who don't comply will be fined. In Singapore, if you don't get a shot and you get COVID, well, you'll have to pay the medical costs yourself. All this to say, while Quebec's vax tax seems drastic, other places could soon follow suit. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
It's been more than 2 weeks since a volcano on Spain's Canary Islands stopped erupting, but reconstruction efforts are only starting. The volcano on the island of La Palma spewed lava and ash for more than 3 months. It destroyed thousands of homes and hundreds of acres of cropland. Now residents are banding together to rebuild their lives and demanding more support from the government in Madrid. From Spain, The World's Lucia Benavides reports.
25-year-old Alexandra Gomez was not prepared for an evacuation. Authorities had initially warned the volcano would explode farther away. When we saw the explosion and noticed the lava was headed our way, she says, we ran out of the house with just the clothes on our back. Gomez, who lives with her mother and brother, has been staying at a relative's house since. But because the lava flowed a lot slower than first expected, she was able to return to her house twice before it was completely destroyed.
Y yo entré, cogí una manta que me había bordado mi bisabuela a mano y un par de cosas así de valor sentimental, las metí en el coche y mirando el volcán me eché a llorar.
She says she grabbed several sentimental belongings, including a blanket hand-sewn by her great-grandmother. As she put them in the car, she looked up at the exploding volcano and cried. Gomez is one of more than 2,000 people on the island of La Palma who've lost their home to a blanket of lava. It's estimated that the lava destroyed 1,600 buildings and 50 miles of roads. Other neighborhoods are completely covered by thick layers of ash. From a distance, they look like dark gray sand dunes that have swallowed trees and houses. Over the past few weeks, emergency service personnel and volunteers have been working around the clock to dig them out. But Carlos Clemente, from a newly formed association of residents affected by the volcano, says the future remains uncertain.
De las donaciones que el dinero que ha dado la gente no se ha recibido y ayudas estatales ninguna tampoco.
He says residents haven't received any donations yet or the millions of euros promised by the Spanish government. He blames local officials for mismanagement of funds. Clemente says his own mother is in dire need of support. She's 75 years old and lost her house along with all of her belongings. That includes precious photographs and letters.
Tenemos claro que esto no se va a reconstruir en un año. Esto va a ser un tema muy largo.
Rebuilding our lives and communities will be a long process, he says, and it's up to public officials to listen to the needs of those affected. Juan Vicente Rodriguez is another member of the association. He's also the president of a collective of banana farmers whose headquarters was destroyed by the lava.
Se ha perdido en un año de producción unos 50 millones de euros.
He says banana farmers suffered around 50 million euros in damages when the lava ate up more than 900 acres of agricultural fields. Bananas are the island's main export, accounting for 50% of its GDP and providing thousands of jobs.
Si esas fincas no se volvieron a plantar, se va a perder un tejido económico muy importante en el valle.
If these plantations aren't rebuilt, he says, the island will lose an important economic hub. The problem is, the destroyed farmlands are now hardened lava, and Rodriguez says it's unclear if farmers will be able to plant bananas there again. The biggest challenge will be finding new territory to harvest, and there just might not be enough of it.
Mira, las situaciones traumáticas es como una muerte en vida. ¿No?
It's a traumatic situation, he says. People are feeling depressed and desperate. But he adds, it could be a chance to start over by investing in other industries that provide new opportunities. For the world, I'm Lucia Benavides.
Economists are confirming what you already know. Inflation is real. You've no doubt noticed it at the grocery store. Just ahead, what that means for people in other countries managing their food budgets. Plus, in Ireland, a guaranteed salary is helping artists stay afloat. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Artists everywhere have had a tough time these past couple of years. Plays, galleries, and concerts have largely been canceled throughout the pandemic. Now, in Ireland, the government is stepping in to, shall we say, help save the show. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Before the pandemic, Danny Grunland performed at weddings with his band, The Goods. Now, that's not really an option.
Since the pandemic hit, that just dried up completely, so there was no way of making any sort of money. It's just been terrible. It's kind of decimated the whole industry here.
Grunland has had to get a job outside of the industry to make ends meet. It pays the bills, but he would much rather be making music. On top of the financial strain, Irish musician Riona Sally Hartman says it's been hard to stay motivated.
Creatively, it's been pretty tough, as in there's very little audience feedback, very little performing.
Now, some relief is on the way. The Irish government will soon start paying a basic income to about 2,000 artists. Details are still being finalized, but each person will likely get around $370 a week, every week, for the next 3 years.
I think this is a once-in-a-generation policy intervention.
Catherine Martin is the country's Minister for Arts and Culture. She says the 2,000 artists will be from a wide range of disciplines.
So that could be visual arts, theatre, literature, music, dance, opera, film, circus, architecture.
And the selection process will not be needs-based. Artists will be chosen at random. This is a pilot program, and Martin says she'll be looking at a few key measures of success.
Does it provide the artists and creatives with the opportunity to increase their practice? Does it minimize the loss of skills, and does it contribute to sectoral regrowth?
Musician Danny Grenland expects that, yes, a weekly basic income would help accomplish all of that. But to him, the government's commitment to the arts is almost more important.
It shows artists and musicians that they're seen and they're actually contributing to society.
Artists began lobbying for basic income long before the pandemic. Leave O'Donohue volunteers with the National Campaign for the Arts, a grassroots organization in Ireland. She says, in a way, the pandemic helped highlight their cause.
What really kept the public going through the crisis was the arts. You know, it was the books we were reading, the music, the poetry, the TV. And I think there's, for the first time, a really strong sense of how fundamental the arts are for a functioning society and for our health and well-being.
That message and the idea of basic income is making its way around the globe. Canada, France, and Finland have tested similar programs, as has San Francisco. Aisa Villarosa helps run that program from the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. Since last spring, 130 artists have received $1,000 a month.
Guaranteed income isn't about deservedness. This isn't about merit-based grants.
Villarosa says some people have used the money for rent or to buy tools for their art. But one choreographer, who thought she would need to let her dancers go, decided to pay the money forward.
With the funding, she actually paid her dancers through the pandemic. And it's such a beautiful example of this is generative work, right? It is about people giving back.
8 months into the project, Villarosa says her team has learned a few lessons, including how crucial it is to involve community members at every step.
From questions of, do folks get a cash gift card? Does someone need a social security number? And each of those questions and each of those decision points can be a gatekeeper to the family, to the artist who's most in need.
Ireland's pilot is doing just that right now. Artists and the general public can give input on how they think the basic income should be distributed and managed. The consultation phase ends at the end of January. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
High inflation persists in many countries across the globe. In Europe, rates are higher than they've been in 20 years. Here in the U.S., it's been 40 years since we saw rates this high. But the numbers don't entirely explain the soaring cost of food. Since the start of the pandemic, food prices globally have increased some 40% and continue to rise. To help us understand what's happening, we're joined by Desmond Lachman. He's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. Let's talk first, Desmond, about the recent numbers from the U.S. and Europe. Who's getting hit the hardest?
Well, the U.S. is being hit harder than Europe. That the numbers that came out today, you know, showed inflation up by 7%. You know, that's the highest inflation that we've had since 1982. Europe is also suffering from the worst inflation that they've had since the launching of the euro in 1999.
And then you've got some countries like Brazil and Turkey. They're in double digits, right?
Turkey is now running inflation at around about 30%. The currency looks like it's in free fall. Brazil, inflation's in double digits as well.
When it comes to food, though, I mean, since the start of the pandemic, food prices have outpaced overall inflation. Why is that?
We've had a perfect storm, you know, so we've had the impact of climate change. We've had droughts in a lot of places, floods in other places. Then we've had all sorts of problems with the pandemic. We've had supply side disruptions as a result of that. We've had shipping costs going through the roof. We've then also had the impact of, you know, Chinese swine flu that put pressure on grain prices. So all of that is coming together. And at the same time, what's occurring is that governments are giving money to their citizens to cope with the pandemic. You know, that money begins to put pressure as well. What is a little troubling is that some of these factors might be indicating longer-term trends, you know, that they might not reverse. I'm thinking mainly of climate change. You know, if we have these changes in weather patterns that are of a more permanent nature, we could be in real trouble. You know, in fact, the World Bank has warned that the cost of climate change could be something like 100 million people in the developing countries. They could be forced back into poverty.
Desmond, I wonder if you've looked into what this could mean for overall nutrition globally. I mean, are things so bad that the UN's Millennium Development Goals could be set back?
Oh, absolutely. I think that in the developing countries, food is just so much more important that they've got limited amounts of income. You know, if you raise the food prices, their money doesn't go that far, you know, and you do get nutritional problems.
What do you think needs to happen to address this continued increase in food prices? Is there anything that can be done?
If we get the whole of the world vaccinated, that can deal with the pandemic, that can cause supply chain problems to be repaired, the shipping, all of that would provide some kind of relief. And then longer term, you know, one really does have to address the climate change issue.
The chair of the Federal Reserve admitted yesterday that its own policy may be contributing to global inflation. Can you explain that?
Oh, I think that is certainly a very important factor in the inflation story. You know, that the Federal Reserve has been printing money. You know, during the pandemic, it's increased by more than 30%. That's by far the fastest rate of money printing that we've had in the last 40 years or so. So very expansive monetary policy is occurring at the same time that we've had the largest peacetime budget stimulus on record. All of that has just been made worse by the supply side problems. But the Fed has to bear quite a lot of the responsibility for the inflation that we're seeing right now.
Desmond Lachman is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. Thank you very much for helping us understand this better.
My pleasure talking to you.
We'll be right back with more in the next half hour. You're listening to The World. Indonesia, the world's largest exporter of coal for electricity. But the country halted that and needs the coal for itself. The ban put a pinch on nations nearby.
Today we are on yellow alert in the Philippines.
In other words, get ready for blackouts if the ban is not lifted soon. Also ahead, a reality check on coal consumption since the climate conference. It's on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Brussels today, NATO and Russia are in talks. NATO allies are concerned about Russia's military buildup near Ukraine's border. But boots on the ground are not the only threat that's raising concern. In the past, Russia has used an array of other tools to destabilize its adversaries, including cyber. Yesterday, three of the U.S. agencies that focus on cybersecurity released a report detailing the tools the Kremlin has. To discuss, we're joined now by Chris Krebs. From 2018 to 2020, he was the director of CISA, which means he was the top person responsible for improving cybersecurity across the U.S. government. That report I just mentioned came out from CISA, along with the FBI and the National Security Agency. Chris, what stands out to you from this report? What do we know now that we didn't before?
It's a pretty remarkable report, both for what it says and what it doesn't say. So first on what it says is it gives a very broad rundown of the capabilities, the techniques of the various cyber operators affiliated with the Russian government. And they are quite capable. And so it gives cyber defense teams good insight and things to look for, as well as some good guidance on how to prepare in the coming weeks and months. But more importantly, I think what is not in the alert is the timing of the alert. As you mentioned, U.S. government officials are negotiating and having discussions with the Russians. And assuming those do not play out well and the Russians, in fact, move into Ukraine, the U.S. government and their allies, our allies, will take pretty strong steps from what I understand, including very, very aggressive sanctions. And that will stoke the ire of the cyber operators. And I would expect them, and I think that's what the U.S. government expects, that some of those Russian government cyber operators will then strike out at U.S. companies and other organizations. Again, assuming a series of events takes place, including robust sanctions from the U.S. government.
Right. So in recent memory, we've covered the SolarWinds hack and the Colonial Pipeline attack. Are these some of the major cyber breaches that this report is responding to?
Partly. I think the SolarWinds or the broader Russian SVR, which is the equivalent effectively of the CIA, that's probably the most recent. But the Russian government cyber operators have been very active over the last several years, not just here in the US, but also, I think, probably more notably in Ukraine. 2 years in a row, they shut down the electric grid right around Christmas time. And also, my first year in the Trump administration, they are responsible for a Ukrainian origin event known as NotPetya that unfortunately had global cascades. So I think organizations really need to be thinking about the first order effect. You know, what happens if Russia does in fact move into Ukraine? If you have operations there, you need to be thinking about what the impacts are. But what are going to be the secondary and tertiary effects, including if the U.S. responds with sanctions, how will the Kremlin react?
On the defensive side, Chris, has the U.S. government been able to build up some of its cyber infrastructure to prevent similar action from Russia in the future? And does it do that in coordination with the private assets that might be attacked?
So CISA has been doing a good job quietly over the last several months of engaging private sector partners as we've seen this build up along the Ukrainian border. There has been a pretty substantial emphasis on improving critical infrastructure cybersecurity over the last several years. In fact, going back several administrations. But there's still a significant amount of work to do because, unfortunately, the adversary gets a vote too. And the increase of defensive capabilities is not always directly pegged to the sophistication or capability of the adversary. So as we improve defenses, we have to continue to make the bad guys pay and make them not want to play the game anymore. And that's just cost imposition and deterrence.
And when it comes to offense or retaliation, is the U.S. also capable of similar cyber attacks on Russian assets as a response to Russia's action? And has the U.S. shown a willingness to strike back?
You know, without getting to any specific capabilities directly targeting the Russians, I think if you step back, I mean, the American government between the intelligence community and the Department of Defense Cyber Command has been in this game for quite some time. They are remarkably capable, and our adversaries recognize that. So we absolutely have capabilities. And I think we have a different value system, though, in which we use them. We certainly, like the Chinese government, we do not use our capabilities for domestic commercial gain, which they've been known to do. And we stay away from critical infrastructure. I mean, that's just kind of the rules-based order that we stick to, that our, unfortunately, our adversaries don't always play by the same game.
I know you said, Chris, that the U.S. has a different value system, but I do wonder why the U.S. is in a position to call out other countries who do this stuff if the U.S. is engaged in it as well.
Well, I think you have to differentiate the sorts of actions that we're talking about here. Intelligence collection is as old as mankind. But when we talk about cyber disruption operations against critical infrastructure, against energy grids, against communications infrastructure, in a steady state peacetime, that is just not the way that I think the U.S., our allies in the West and elsewhere have engaged.
Chris Krebs, you've seen this from the inside. What are some of the biggest holes in the U.S. government's cybersecurity right now? And as I look at the calendar at next November in the 2022 midterms, what are your concerns and how will Washington actually answer them?
So I think generally in the United States, there are absolutely some underperforming sectors within the critical infrastructure community that the government has to help. And we have to continue providing them support and resources. But there are going to be areas where there's been market failures. And I would expect to see regulation to some degree over the course of the next year or so. We've already seen some regulatory enhancements in the pipeline sector. This summer, the Transportation Security Administration used some of their authorities. We've seen the same in the rail and public transportation sector. I would also hope that the Congress can pass a cyber incident notification requirement. We don't even have that, right? In the U.S., if you suffer an attack from a foreign government or a foreign cyber criminal, you have no obligation or requirement to report that to the United States government. And that puts the defenders and the policymakers at a disadvantage when they're trying to formulate their own strategies and dialogue with the foreign adversary. So we need at a minimum that cyber notification requirement. But to your point about elections, we still have work to do. We need to continue investing in American election administration and systems, robust post-election pre-certification audits, but also recognize that our adversaries are not just using technical means like targeting election systems, but they're using dis and misinformation to undermine confidence. And that's probably my greatest concern going forward, is just the soft space in between our ears, frankly, that the bad guys are really starting to tune in on and drive a lot of dissonance across America and drive a deep wedge in between us.
Chris Krebs was a director of CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, from 2018 to 2020. He's now a partner with the Krebs Stamos Group, a cybersecurity consultancy, and was speaking with us about a new advisory issued by the U.S. government on mitigating Russian cyber threats. Chris, good to speak with you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Indonesia is the world's largest exporter of thermal coal. That's the type of coal used primarily to produce electricity. Countries across Asia depend on Indonesia's coal to make their economies run. But since the 1st of January, Indonesia has banned exports of coal. They are poised to lift that ban soon. Even so, the news led to a regional backlash. Ashley Westerman reports.
Just before the new year, Indonesia's government got a dire warning from its largest utility company, PLN. Their domestic stockpiles of coal were critically low, and there may not be enough of it to keep all the lights on.
It would be very embarrassing for the government if we started the year of 2022 with massive blackouts. So the government enacted quickly with the export ban.
Rocky Inton is with the think tank CSIS Indonesia. He says the reason Indonesia is in this situation is because basically coal producers make more money exporting their product than selling it at government-capped prices to domestic buyers, utilities like PLN.
Many long-term contracts abroad, especially from East Asia, China, South Korea, Japan. So once PLN loses out because of lower domestic prices, it became a problem.
This landed the government, Inton says, in a catch-22.
The government, on the one hand, is caught between the interests of the consumers, represented by PLN, and on the other hand, it also wants to help the export performance.
They chose the ban, which went into effect on January 1st, driving up coal prices across the Asia Pacific and stranding vessels filled with coal in Indonesian harbors. Soon, countries that depend on Indonesia's coal, including South Korea, Japan, and the Philippines, were calling for the ban to be eased. Alberto Dalusong III is an energy policy expert with the Manila-based Institute for Climate and Sustainable Cities.
Everyone may be impacted, but I believe that in ASEAN, it's the Philippines that is the most impacted by the export ban.
ASEAN is the acronym for the 10-member Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Over 50% of the power in the Philippines is generated by coal, Dalusong says, and they don't really have other reliable energy alternatives, like Vietnam has hydropower and Malaysia has oil and gas.
If it was a longer period of export ban, it would definitely mean blackouts. Even without that, today we are on yellow alert in the Philippines, meaning not enough coal capacity.
Luckily, Indonesia would like to start shipping coal again. It means their coal companies will make money. And earlier this week, the government said Indonesia's major utility is seeing much better supply conditions. But they want to make sure the domestic coal needs are met before removing the ban.
You know, a ban for all of January would have had a major impact on global markets.
Rory Symington is a research analyst at Wood Mackenzie. Indonesia supplies nearly half of the global thermal coal market, exporting over 400 million tons in 2020. Symington says the Indonesian government also needs to address how much coal producers need to save for the domestic market and the price cap on domestic sales, because
what it effectively means at the moment is that producers would be selling the coal for about half the value that they could get if they were exporting it.
The government says they're looking into both of those issues. So even if the ban is eased or lifted, Symington says there's still a lot of uncertainty moving forward. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman in Manila.
You may remember that last fall at the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, world leaders agreed to phase down coal-fired power. But as you heard in Ashley's story, coal is still very much alive as a fuel source. The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, is here for a status check on global coal use. Carolyn, what progress has been made on phasing down coal since COP26 in early November?
Well, demand for coal did fall a bit in the first year of the pandemic as energy demands were lower and industrial activity, you know, ground to a halt for a time. That led some people to think that maybe global coal demand actually peaked back in 2018, which would be very good for the environment. Coal-fired electricity is the single biggest contributor of greenhouse gases to our atmosphere. But then 2021 came around. The global economy was on the rebound, energy demand soared, and actually more electricity was produced by coal than ever before. And the International Energy Agency predicts that global coal use for every application, not just electricity generation, will hit an all-time high in 2 years' time, which it calls a worrying sign of just how far off track the world is in reaching its net zero carbon emission goals.
Yeah, that's kind of discouraging. So what is causing this increase?
Well, for years now, the story of coal has been that it's been declining in developed economies like the U.S. and Europe, but increasing in many developing and emerging economies. But last year, it actually increased not only in China and India, which account for two-thirds of the world's coal consumption, but also in the U.S. and Europe. Here in the U.S., coal consumption was up 17% last year, largely because of high natural gas prices. And an early analysis from a research firm called the Rhodium Group that was released this week showed that that increase in coal use was the reason why greenhouse gas emissions last year outpaced the increase in GDP.
That is really extraordinary. I mean, every country you mentioned, India, China, the U.S., has pledged to reach net zero emissions by sometime mid-century. But as you say, they're burning more coal, the dirtiest energy source. Is that going to change anytime soon?
Well, this uptick in coal consumption is expected to just be a blip in the U.S. and Europe. But globally, coal consumption is expected to continue to rise for the next few years before settling into a plateau around the same time that the International Energy Agency says it actually needs to drop by about 20% in order to keep this net zero by mid-century goal viable. So this is definitely an example of a mismatch between these long-term net zero goals we keep hearing about and near-term policy to make it happen. One thing that I'm going to be watching for in the next year is whether developed countries that have gotten rich off of burning coal for the last 150 years start doing more to try to help developing economies move away from that fuel source. There's an interesting announcement at the Glasgow Climate Summit where the U.S. and European countries pledged about $8 billion to help South Africa move away from coal and develop alternative sources of income for coal miners. Mm. And I'm interested in watching how that progresses and also if initiatives like that end up being rolled out to other countries.
The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, thank you very much for the update.
Thank you, Marco.
Watching the clock. It can be hard not to do, waiting for something to happen, like the end of the workday or when that thing in the microwave is ready. The job of a soccer referee, aside from keeping a close eye for fair play on the pitch, is to watch the clock. And if they don't pay attention, you get this.
Well, controversy. In Limbe.
That's Limbe, Cameroon, where teams from Mali and Tunisia met in their opening match in the Africa Cup of Nations. The ref stopped the clock early, not once, but twice. The second half began with a successful penalty kick by Mali's Ibrahima Kone.
Ibrahima Kone, left-footed, scores, sending the keeper the wrong way.
BN Sports covering what would be the only goal of the game, dramatic enough, until the ref, Johnny Sikazwe, blew the whistle to end the game at 85 minutes of play. They still had at least another five to go. Realizing the error and sensing the anger from the Tunisia bench, Sikazwe started the clock again, but apparently could not keep his finger off the stop time button. He blew the whistle again at 89 minutes.
Johnny Sikazwe signals that Mali have won this game 1-0, and it's only now that we're going to tick out round to 90 minutes on the clock.
Tunisia's coach, understandably, was apoplectic.
Moulay Kabaya is furious. He thought he was going to get a lot longer with 11 against 10. Surely there had to be some stoppage time for the VAR hold-ups.
But wait, it did not end there. During the post-match press conference, the coach from Mali was suddenly told that the remaining time would be played out with a different ref. None too happy with the news, the Malians walked back out to the pitch, but the angry Tunisians refused to come out. As a commentator from Sky TV said about the lone Malian team on the field,
nothing really happened, but they're celebrating their win, and they have now officially been declared 1-0 winners. I'm pretty sure we'll get to the bottom of this and find out exactly what has happened.
Or will we? Craters are appearing in central Turkey, the worrying result of a prolonged drought. The sinkholes vary in size. Some are as small as a watermelon. Others are large enough to gobble up an apartment building. There are thousands of these craters presenting major problems to farmers in the region. The world's Duri Baskaran reports from Konya, Turkey.
A few weeks ago, in a cornfield just outside Jafer Ata's house, the earth opened up. Ata, a sheep herder, takes us to the site, shaking his head. I don't know what to say, he says. It's bad. It's a smaller sinkhole, about 10 feet deep. A sheep herder he knows fell into another one and was stuck for 2 days, he says. It feels like they're everywhere. Back at Ata's home, over cups of strong, sweet tea, he explains that the sinkholes have long been a fact of life here, but the loss of groundwater is making the sinkholes appear more and more frequently. He and his wife, Atiye, have to keep a mental map of them so the sheep don't fall in while they're grazing in open fields. Atiye says that the past 3 years have been so dry that it's hard to find green pastures where their animals can feed. So now they have to buy feed from the market and sell some of their flock to pay for it. It's not a long-term fix. We can go hungry, but we won't let our animals go hungry, Ata says. The Ata's village sits in a part of central Turkey that has long been the country's breadbasket. Historically, farmers grew wheat, but later shifted to water-intensive crops like sugar beets and corn. As a result, the winter landscape is a mix of dry, parched browns and swaths of emerald green. Farmers that can afford it install underground water pumps to irrigate their fields. Every year, they have to dig deeper. Ata doesn't like the situation, but he understands why people do it. He says he'd build a well if he could, but he can't afford the electricity to run it. The sinkholes can show up overnight or grow slowly and steadily. They range in size from a tiny tunnel that could be mistaken for a squirrel's burrow to one that's at least 300 feet deep. It's just a short walk from the highway. Crumbling earth around the edges of the crater show that it's growing. Already, it looks large enough to swallow a farmhouse. In the nearby city of Konya, scientists are looking for a solution. Fethullah Arik is a geologist and director of the Sinkhole Application Research Center at Konya Technical University. As we walk in an open field near an industrial park, he points out the different types of sinkholes littering the ground. He and his team have cataloged more than 2,000 sinkholes in the Konya area. At least 700 of them, he says, are big ones. Arik says he and his team are developing ways to predict where sinkholes will appear, using underground radar and taking soil samples. Some sinkholes grow along underground fault lines that can be measured and studied. Other times, cracks in a garden wall or a door frame are the first signs that danger is coming. Arik says they are trying to make the case to business owners and people in government that sinkholes aren't just a threat to farmers. Each factory around the field where we're standing could have structural problems if a sinkhole appeared beneath it. And this is a mounting problem. Climate change predictions for central Turkey include longer droughts and higher temperatures. Advocates are calling for different ways to control water use, but there are no easy solutions. Mustafa Baldinoglu takes a break from operating a tractor at his family's dairy farm in a village outside the town of Karpınar, an area with one of the highest concentrations of sinkholes. Growing up, the village would get plenty of rain, he says. But today, after almost 3 years of drought, they have to rely on groundwater pumps to grow animal feed. He says, we used to draw water from 20 meters down. Now it's from 55, 60 meters below. Sinkholes appear in the village with relative frequency, but neighbors say most are small enough to be repaired. There's just no alternative, he says. The water has to come from somewhere. For the world, I'm Duri Baskaran, in Konya, Turkey.
Time to tango with a feminist flair. Women in Argentina are trying to revamp the traditional and often sexist reputation of tango music, which dates back to the 19th century. You heard the story about this from The World's Lucia Benavides, but you got to check out the pictures too. Head over to theworld.org/Instagram. Let's take a little walk with a Canadian man who likes to sing. We're not in a church. This comes from a culvert that runs under a street in his hometown of Sudbury, Ontario. He likes the acoustics. Who doesn't enjoy a good echoey tunnel? For Christian Howald, it's a passion. Howald was born in Switzerland, so maybe that's what made him a natural.
My mother always yodeled, but I didn't really. I was always embarrassed of my voice.
It was only after he'd grown up in rural Ontario that Howald taught himself Swiss yodeling songs, like this one, to share with his children.
We have a group of friends we went kayaking with, discovered how cool it sounds in valleys and tunnels.
It's these tunnels that have brought Christian Howald a kind of celebrity.
A Sudbury man's getting a lot of national attention these days for his yodeling skills. He's become known for performing in tunnels around the city, and he recently started a YouTube page.
This is Howald in a kayak under a boardwalk at a nature preserve. After his wife began posting videos of his yodeling, total strangers started making requests.
Could you do this song? Could you do that song? So I just started making videos and posting them, and it just exploded. The idea is letting loose. So having sang with professional opera singers, they're taught to be perfect. With yodeling, you let that go. You have to find that epiglottal break where you go to the lowest voice possible to the highest voice possible. And it's just to not be embarrassed.
Howald says yodeling is great for your mental health. One more trick for getting through the pandemic.
And this year, you have to breathe. And it is impossible to say something negative while you're yodeling.
One last song now from Christian Howald, a standard known in English as the King's Yodeler. Sudbury, Ontario's lonesome yodeler, Christian Howald, speaking there with CBC Radio's Morning North. Howald gets the last syllable today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Breathe deep, exhale, repeat, and we'll see you right back here tomorrow.